Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal, which aims to make sense of our COVID-19 world today and tomorrow. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi, researcher, author, and speaker from Brand Positive. As a researcher, I've spent 20 years conducting ethnographic interviews on global projects. Along the way, I've been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom I'll be talking to in this series. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, empathy, and privacy, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, looked into innovation, behavioural change, and the climate crisis. So, I hope you enjoy the interviews, and if so, please tell your friends, leave a rating, and watch out for our other episodes. Now, without further delay, let's crack on with today's podcast. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Scott Goodson. Scott Goodson is an entrepreneur. He's an angel investor in 10 companies. He's the founder and CEO of Strawberry Frog, who last year won the Best Marketing Agency of the Year Award, care of the drum. The agency is the world's first movement marketing company. He invented the idea of movement marketing and covered it in his best-selling book, Uprising. The team at Strawberry Frog deliver what they term as movement inside, which essentially are original and refreshing ways for CEOs and leaders to transform their organizations and change culture, habits, and behaviors, alongside movement outside, which is a marketing framework to grow brands and companies with movement, strategy, and creativity. Scott's been doing this for 25 years. He's worked with a fairly astonishing array of iconic brands and businesses, including Procter & Gamble, Emirates Airline, Google, PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, SunTrust, Morgan Stanley, ASICS, SmartCar, and along with people like the governments of Dubai and the first Abu Dhabi Bank. He's spoken on movement marketing at Harvard Business School, Columbia, the Cannes Lion Festival, TEDx, BBC World Service, CNN, NPR, etc., and has appeared in a whole array of media titles like the New York Times, the FT, Wall Street Journal, Economist, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, and Forbes. Meanwhile, having just spoken to him, I know that he's now in a rather leafy part of New York. So, Scott, how are you?
I am doing really well, Sean. Thank you for the kind introduction. You made me sound very old. Such a list of accomplishments, yeah.
But meanwhile, you're saying that it's great that you've got you're sitting there with the we probably can hear it is the bird song of New York currently being broadcasted or sort of sent around the world. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's the sounds of quarantine, and you know, as we humans have receded, the animals have come forward, and the birds are just out in full swing, and it's beautiful.
Very nice.
And the sun, yeah, it's great.
And the sun. And so, so obviously, in terms of time, I mean, it's early afternoon over here in the UK. So obviously, sort of morning in New York. And so, I mean, just before we get into talking around issues around business and organization and culture and society, just for you, sort of personally, how's it been so far in terms of the great lockdown, the great psychological experiment, as they say?
I mean, I'm not as fragile as I thought I was, and I think we've done very well. Kudos to my team. I mean, early on in March, we started to follow events as they were unfolding, both in New York but beyond. And I think we came to the realization that we should start working remotely quite early. So we shifted to full remote work early March. So the whole organization was out working then. And before we did that, we sort of had a week inside the company where we went through all the technology we were going to need to use, but also protocols, because protocols are really critical. And also some basic tenets like always have positive intent. You know, when you communicate through email with your colleagues, sometimes you misunderstand a meaning. So you know, as a general rule, anytime you get an email, everyone's trying to work together. So, you know, those things really helped us establish a protocol and a culture so that when we went full remote, it was quite seamless, actually. I mean, then it took a week and then things were pretty great. And we've been working that way ever since. We've done about, you know, a dozen productions now. And all of it has been pulled together, managed, and executed by an extraordinary team remotely, both inside, both with Strawberry Frog teammates and also our partners and production companies and so forth.
Well, fantastic. I love that idea of laying those protocols out so clearly and really making a big deal about positive intent. It's a fantastic fantastic ethos. I mean, from the point of view of, I mean, looking forward and slightly putting you on the spot, I mean, certainly over here in the UK, there's a lot of talk in agency circles, both, you know, talks at events, obviously online events, or in the marketing press about when the drift back to work starts. And in some sectors, I'm sure same of there, you know, there's some sort of movement in that regard. A lot of talk about the fact that Adland, in all of its guises, is going to be fairly long, you know, a long way down the list in terms of government priorities and in terms of, you know, which businesses they encourage to get back out there. And from the point of view of things like the practicalities of social distancing in businesses, I mean, I know you've got this amazing setup in the Empire State Building. What on earth is going to happen there when you've got presumably, you know, a fairly huge number of offices in the Empire State Building with that epic view, but everyone's got to go through the same entrance, get in the same elevator, etc., etc.?
Yeah, I mean, the Empire State Building is definitely an extraordinary space for us. You've been up there, you've seen the view. It's every day it just is just a marvel to see the city from, you know, such a perspective. We can see the East River flowing from the Chrysler Building right down to the Statue of Liberty, and we can see the Hudson River as it meets the head spring of the East River and the bay of the city. It's just it's amazing. And so many things about that building just are extraordinary. Like, for example, I probably didn't know this, but actually, it's designed to move. So when the wind blows really hard, you can actually feel the building kind of shifting. And sometimes people come up for the first time and they just fall to the floor because they think the building is going to fall down. But it's actually designed to move that way. But you know, the question you asked is one that, you know, myself and our management team are thinking about. You know, when do we go back to work at the Empire State Building? I mean, we, this follows, you know, a number of agencies here in the United States who have made the decision already to bring their teams back. And as you probably have seen, certain states are being a little more aggressive at returning to semi-normal than New York City. So there's a big discussion here also in the United States, you know, when should you bring people back? And, you know, for me personally, I just don't think we'll be able to return to work in our offices in the near future. I mean, Strawberry Frog never closed, obviously. We've been working remotely since early March. And it's brought us closer together as a team with greater solidarity and understanding. And we'll continue to monitor the situation. We're following Governor Cuomo, who has daily press briefings, which are really extraordinary, and Mayor de Blasio. And then we're also keeping an eye on the WHO and the CDC. But for the foreseeable future, you know, we'll continue to work remotely. And, you know, I just don't think we can ask our Frog teammates to return anytime soon, perhaps not until there's immunity through antibodies or mass testing at the least, or even potentially waiting for a vaccine. You raise the question of social distancing, and the reality is inside a large office space, whether it's the Empire State Building or any building for that matter, It's challenging because the pathogen travels through the air conditioning system. You know, those air conditioning systems don't filter out viruses. So there's no protection. Even if you do 6 feet of distancing, there's just no guarantee that you're going to, you know, limit the pathogen from passing through the air vent.
Mm. Wow. And by the way, in terms of the issue of the impact, leaving aside, if one almost can, you know, the appalling impact, obviously, in terms of all the dreadful stories about those who've died and who've had sort of, you know, friends and relatives and family members dying. From the aspect of the impact on the industry in terms of jobs, I was talking with another agency leader a couple of days ago who's saying that I find a statistic unbelievable, even on this side of the Atlantic. He's saying there's 20% of the American ad force have effectively been fired, have been let go, which just, just an extraordinary statistic.
Yeah, I mean, I can't attest to the specific numbers because they seem to change on a daily basis and there's a lot of numbers being thrown around. But, you know, regardless, the industry, the whole media industry has just been completely decimated. I mean, everything from the local newspapers, most journalists have been furloughed unless they're working for, you know, a couple of major networks or New York Times. The same as can be said for the marketing industry, digital agencies, marketing agencies, advertising agencies. A lot of those firms have had their staff either furloughed or laid off. In the United States, furloughed doesn't mean the same as it does in the UK. It doesn't mean you get a salary. Here, furloughed means you lose your job and you don't get anything. So unless you apply to get some relief from the government, at the moment, the government has provided $1,200 to every citizen, which, of course, lasts for about maybe, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. So it's really tough. We don't have the social net that there is in the UK. So people who lose their jobs are going to be on unemployment. And if they can't get unemployment, they're going to have to figure out a way to survive. It's not a pretty sight. We haven't laid off anyone. We've been very clear since the beginning with our team that was our priority, to make sure that everyone would stay in their position. So we've made our strategy has been to work to do that, and we've been successful so far. And this is not a sprint. This is obviously a marathon. This will go on for quite a while. So we're looking at the longer term, and we planned our budget and our approach to ensure that all the people at the company are as safe as we can possibly make them.
Well, nice one. That is a admirable bit of leadership there, Scott. Very, very good indeed. Crikey, to put it mildly. What about this situation regarding, you were here, or should I say you were there, at, for instance, around things like 9/11. So, do you do any sort of comparing and contrasting in terms of, you know, the impact on, I don't know, you as a business, on society in general, particularly obviously in New York at that time to today? I mean, are there parallels, or is this a really, really separate issue, you know, across the board? How are you looking at it?
One of the biggest issues that we're going to face, we're facing and we will face is, you know, mental health issues. And I think whether it's this crisis or any past crisis, people will be affected by this. Employees, you know, people working in all sorts of organizations have to deal with, you know, just the panic of the way this whole thing kind of evolved. The anxieties related to that. And then you have, there's just so many other just aspects of this that can cause stress and anxiety, and there's such a stigma obviously around mental health that I don't know how, you know, companies and organizations are going to be able to help their employees. I think it's got to be a priority. You know, there are people who, for example, are living by themselves. They don't have a partner. They don't have a roommate. They're living in their own apartment, small apartment in the middle of New York City. And around them, all they hear all day long are sirens and people in their building who are succumbing to the virus and being pulled out in the middle of the night. It is a really difficult mental state to be in that, you know, constantly, day in and day out. I think, you know, the fear of the unknown. And, you know, we've purposely worked on language and dialogue with our teammates to build confidence, to build strength. I mentioned earlier that we really believe that our objective is to keep our team safe and secure in their roles. And we don't talk about risk. We don't talk about, risk limiting our thinking or stopping us from doing anything. It's really about if we need to, you know, we have a very vibrant intern program called Tadpoles, which we've been running for about, 15 years. And this year we had like 700 applicants and we had to choose from those. And it's a paid internship. We do it every year, around the year. And, you know, we decided this year, just because we were unsure what was going to happen, to just delay it. You know, we didn't cancel it. We delayed it. And just the use of language when you're working with your people and your clients and others, it's really important. You're building a strong sense of confidence in the future, because at the end of the day, all crises end, and this will too. And how you manage yourself through the crisis is really important. But mental health is a thing that I'm very concerned about. And we're working on, as you mentioned at the top of the show, we work on internal movements for companies and leadership. And we have one program that we're working on right now with one client that is a mental health movement to deal with the stigma of mental health and to help solve some of these issues that I raised with employees. It is a huge issue today and will become a massive issue in the years to come.
Mm. Whoa, absolutely phenomenal. I mean, just again, making sort of a slightly sort of clumsy move forward, but I think still very much linking with that ethos. I mean, I do remember, obviously, I've known you for quite a while, and you were very kind to give me some really interesting quotes from my first book, The Post-Truth Business, and particularly around the areas of, you know, sort of ethical behavior, ethical business, issues regarding humane capitalism, and putting what has been used for many, many years and has almost been derided in terms of brand purpose. You gave me some interesting examples there of doing things that actually do live up to that, that just don't use it as a sort of as a glib saying. And one of them, I remember you talking about in terms of things like future planning with confidence and also regards to things like mental health, was work you were doing with the Sun Trust Bank, which we don't have in the UK, so there'll be or in Europe, obviously, so there's no knowledge of the actual brand itself over here. But perhaps it's really interesting. Perhaps you just talk us through that in terms of the movement you did there. Because remember, you talked a lot about helping people to, understand their financial situation and building a movement around that. And it was very, very proactive, and it had a very, very beneficial impact on a subject that a lot of people have a real problem talking about. So, just I think as an interesting case history, perhaps to just remind me about that and tell the listeners all about what you did.
Well, I mean, in recent years, there's a striking consensus that's emerged about the importance of purpose for businesses and brands and its strong correlation with profit. The challenge is that a lot of purpose strategies never get activated. They tend to become like toothless purpose strategies, where they sit in a beautiful PowerPoint presentation in the CEO's desk or the CMO's on the CMO's wall. We did this year, together with Repac, which is a research firm, we created something called the Purpose Power Index. It's the world's first empirical study of purpose brands, measured the impact of those brands on consumers. It was actually selected as by Fast Company as one of the world's greatest ideas for 2020 in the recent May issue. You should check it out, purposepowerindex.com. And it's clear from the research that we did there and also just in other anecdotes that you see that purpose matters, but a lot of organizations just are not very successful at activating the purpose. The specific example that you raise of SunTrust was a financial institution, one of the largest in the United States, that had a purpose, which was lighting the way to financial well-being. And they have an extraordinary leader, a visionary marketing leader, and others in the leadership, including the CEO of SunTrust, which now, by the way, has merged with another financial institution called BB&T to create Truist, which is an even larger group that we're working with. But getting back to SunTrust, they had the purpose, and we were asked by Susan Summersill Johnson, CMO, to turn that into a movement that activated the purpose among the employees of the organization as well as among customers, clients, and prospects. And what we did when we took the purpose, which is a great idea because it really focuses you on the customer, right? Like a good purpose should move you from you, this great company of ours, to the customer. What's in the customer's mind? What are their issues? So lighting the way to financial well-being it's about the customer's well-being. It's about the customer's, let's say, empowerment. And but then how do you turn that into a human-friendly language so it's not so theoretical? So we came up with something called the On-Up Movement. The On-Up Movement is designed to move people from financial stress. When I say people, I should say people, their families, their friends, their community, their company. So a movement to move people from financial stress to confidence. And it's a huge issue. Just like mental health is going to be a huge issue as a result of this crisis, financial well-being in this country is a huge crisis. Even before this coronavirus situation, 80% of Americans couldn't put $2,000 together in 2 weeks in an emergency. I mean, that is extraordinary. Think about it, you know? And so you have, you know, put yourself in a situation where you're a mom and a father and your son or daughter has got accepted to university. And instead of feeling joy and happiness at that moment, you feel dread and anxiety over how you're going to pay for that, you know, expensive college for the next 4 years. So that is the issue that we were trying to deal with. Like, how do we get rid of that dread? How do we help people? And the reality is a lot of it's based on budgeting and understanding how you budget and how you know, you're not going to get financial confidence out of the lottery, but you can get it out of your paycheck if you think through it intelligently. So the On-Up Movement was really both an inspirational movement to take a stand against financial stress, but also a practical movement to give people really good continuous ideas on how to manage their budgets. And that kind of evolved. Today, if you look at onup.com, there's over 5.8 million participants in this movement for a financial institution. It's extraordinary.
5.8 million?
Yeah, 5.8 million. Go to onup.com and you can see for yourself. 5.8 million participants. And we actually evolved together with SunTrust a number of initiatives. One of them was an 8-point program that had been developed by the company to help corporations with their employees, to help them move from financial stress to confidence. Because, you know, if you think about it, a lot of leaders in corporations are concerned about both the mental health, the physical health, as well as the financial well-being of their employees. So we developed a program called Momentum On Up, which is a program that SunTrust provided. I mean, they did all the heavy lifting inside the in order to turn that into a viable program. We packaged it, and it was distributed to corporations across the country, such as Delta Airlines and Home Depot and huge companies, which they then provided to their employees to help them move from financial stress to financial confidence. So that movement, you know, was a powerful force that achieved their business objectives, which were to increase the number of new accounts. So from a, you know, what is our business objective? That was one of them. But it achieved what a traditional advertising campaign historically would have done. But in addition to that, it increased the tenure of employees. It decreased the turnover. It built a strong culture. It unified the people inside the organization, the teammates, in a strong, powerful feeling of unity and focus in what they were doing on a daily basis. And keep in mind that, you know, a lot of people working in financial companies are tellers, you know, working face-to-face with consumers. And even they want to feel that they have a strong reason for being and to help their customers and their community. So it was a really great movement. It's been going since 2015. We're now, it's like 5 years in, and we are now shifting to the launch of Truist. As I mentioned, it's now merged with SunTrust is merged with BB&T, and there's a extraordinary group of leaders in BB&T that we're now working with together with some folks from leaders from SunTrust, and we're working on a new program for the Truist Financial, which is just launching. And we're launching it actually in the middle of the pandemic, which is presents a number of challenges.
Yeah. Well, to put it mildly. And just taking that point forward, it's really, really fascinating, but or perhaps sort of taking it sideways. I mean, again, to go back to where we were fairly near the start of the conversation, I mean, you know, you've been in the industry for a long time now, and you know, you've obviously been very successful running the business in different countries, etc. But you know, during that time, there have been, you know, lots of changes, to put it mildly, in the marketing world, in all of its guises. How do you see, you know, what have been some of the big shifts that you've noted running the agency over those years in terms of what it is, let's say, that clients now want from their agencies? So, you know, has the requirement changed? Or quite frankly, if, you know, to put it in New York terms, if one of those typical sort of, you know, mad men from the 1950s walks through the door, could they still do it? Or has the box of tricks really changed, and has the requirement changed?
I mean, I think there's a lot of different needs out there. Clearly, there are some clients out there that are just looking for, you know, really cool creative and working with very much traditional creative agencies. But I think there's also clients out there looking for bigger ideas to help transform the culture of the organization and also the way that they engage their customers, clients. And I think it's clearer today that, you know, the winners, if you can call them winners, but those who will thrive, let's say, out of this crisis will be those that have a strong purpose. I think companies that haven't activated their purpose have kind of been like a rudderless ship in a squall. I mean, you know, they're moving from tacking one way and tacking the other way and kind of trying to flaying through this. I think companies that have had a clear purpose, it's like anything in life. If you have clear values, regardless of what you're facing, you always revert to those values and you always be fine. Because they represent the strength and the security that allow you to be fearless. If you have no security and no strength, it's hard. You're just fearful. You have nothing to, there's no stability. So I think a purpose functions very much in the same way as values do for humans. And I think, so there are companies out there that are looking for that. And there are companies out there that are looking for, you know, cheap artificial intelligence created content. And you know, there are a couple of large marketing advertising agencies here, digital agencies here, which have grown extraordinarily quickly over the last couple of years in social media, that deliver, you know, 10 campaigns or 50 campaigns for the price of what other strategic companies do. But it's very much like throwing spaghetti on the wall and seeing what sticks. They use that as a selling point to say that, you know, we'll throw 50 campaigns out there, we'll shoot them on iPhones and see what sticks, and whatever does, we'll just put money behind it. The challenge with that, I think there's two issues. Number one, it's only a hair away from machine created content when you're working like that. Machines probably can do that better because they would be less, they would have fewer mistakes. They'd probably figure out faster what type of content humans would prefer. So I think they're doing themselves a disservice that over a very short period of time, they will disappear and machine learning, AI developed content will take over. And the second is that it's just not strategic. You know, it's very hard to deliver a strategic idea when you're throwing 50 pieces of spaghetti on the wall to see what's going to stick. So it definitely delivers short-term results, but not a longer-term culture. So different clients, different needs. We are designed for those companies out there, you know, large corporations who maybe feel that their best years are behind them and really want to make themselves modern and a real competitor for the future, to be one of the most competitive companies, want radical growth. So what we do when we work with those companies, we go in there, we do a deep dive and understanding the culture. And a lot of these companies have been around for 50 years, 100 years, and they just have become irrelevant. Their processes and systems that are designed for efficacy and operational excellence have made them have prevented them from being innovative, have prevented them from adopting breakthrough ideas. And so we go in there and we create the framework and the structure to enable CEOs and other leaders to implement the kind of change they need to make that organization relevant. And that means building collaborative culture inside the company. So a movement, one of the benefits of a movement is it builds collaboration in areas that most corporations don't collaborate. It is a tool for leadership. You know, think about it this way, you know, in today's world, the impact of the de-evolution of leadership, it's no longer possible for a CEO to mandate change in a company. A CEO can no longer stand up and say, okay, I want everyone to do the following. Most people will ignore it, or if they don't like it, they'll leave and go somewhere else. So it's, you know, the best talent aren't going to just follow that mandate. You really need a movement to create motivation, inspiration. You know, think of yourself, Sean, when you when you work with people, you want to be able to be creative. You want to have trust that your fellow colleague is alongside with you, and that together you're working towards a goal. So the movement allows you to do that, and it's a much more effective way of changing employee mindsets, changing the culture. And then externally, with customers and consumers, if you've got that movement, you know, you can do the same. You can motivate people to participate, engage them, like the SunTrust example, and still sell them on products that you need in order to grow your business.
Very good. Really inspiring. I mean, and actually, one of the points that you mentioned there, lots of those sort of, you know, irrelevant businesses that were designed for perhaps a different world or a different way of doing things, is really interesting. So, I mean, and again, going back to another point you made earlier on about, you know, the internship that the agency runs. I mean, you talked about students going to college. What about all those college kids who are now leaving university or education and who are wanting to get into an industry where the industry is certainly at the moment appears to be absolutely, you know, everything's on hold in terms of hiring. So what's your advice going to be to the sort of atypical would-be person who wants to come into the industry sector, who quite frankly cannot find a way in. What do they do? Is it still, can someone do what you did, 20 years ago and set up, like you to try and take on the bigger agencies? Is that opportunity still out there? Or should they be looking in a completely different world? I mean, is the agency world still the one that is as compelling, apart from anything else, as it used to be?
I think the marketing is always going to be an important tool for leadership. Whether you work in, whatever the construct is that you're working in and whatever your role is, whether you're the CEO of a company or the CMO or you run a marketing strategic consultancy or what have you, or creative consultancy, marketing, the ability to communicate, the ability to present ideas is clearly more important today than ever. So I think there's definitely a role for young people. We're actually holding a masterclass for all interns who want to participate in the world. If there's anybody listening to this, they should reach out to Leslie@strawberryfrog.com or Nicola@strawberryfrog.com, and they can get information about that masterclass where we'll be talking about some of those issues for free. It's not a, we're not charging anything. But I would give young people a strong boost of confidence and just say that you have a tremendous opportunity. I mean, probably more so today than in the past, because what we're seeing is the acceleration of the decline of a lot of industries that were already declining. And, the crisis has just accelerated the decline and change. It's a catalyst for great change. And so there's opportunity in that for a lot of young people. It may not be self-evident and maybe not as clear at the moment. But I think if you take a step back, you can see just how fundamentally this is, the whole marketing industry is changing. And anytime there's great change, that means the old guys are kind of stuck trying to scratch their head and figure out a solution. And the young challengers, if they look at it, can find opportunity. And much like I started back in my career, I started when there was the industry was dominated by huge corporate advertising agencies. And my vision back then was, why can't you do a global brand campaign for, one of the world's largest companies in a small team? Why do you need, 1,000 people to turn in a light bulb? Just sounds crazy. And I'd grown up in Sweden, and I worked with a lot of Scandinavian corporations that were just completely aghast with the idea of working with huge American corporate ad agencies. They just thought, what a waste of money. And the Swedes are just much more, they're contrarians, and they just work a lot more efficiently. So when we launched Ericsson mobile phones, it was like the CMO and myself, our backpacks, and we just traveled the world and did it country to country. That's just a different approach than the American model. I think the same is true today. There's a lot of ways to reinvent everything that's being done. So if I was a young person, I would feel emboldened. I would feel excited. And I would just suggest join our masterclass if you want some inspiration, and you're welcome.
Fantastic. And by the way, and when is that going to be? Or is it will be a little rolling thing? Or?
It'll be starting in July.
Okay, cool.
And people can get information from the two contacts I gave you.
Okay, very good. We'll suddenly sort of
and there may be some information on strawberryfrog.com as well.
Yep, okay, nice. What about the issue of types of agencies? And I mean lots of agencies are fairly sort of have morphed into doing sort of horizontally, should we say, so they all sort of are doing a bit of what other people around them are doing, but at the same time agency land in all of its guises does still sort of tend to fall into various pigeonholes. So when you're looking at, you know, you say the accepted role of, you know, creative agencies, inverted commas, versus media agencies, versus PR, versus, you know, straightforward design or whatever, I mean, which of those sort of agency types, if you put it that bluntly, where do you think the energy lies at the moment?
Well, the energy lies in purpose. I think what we're seeing coming out of this is clearly, at least, you know, in the United States, I don't know what it's like in the UK. I mean, I worked in Europe back in the 90s. We worked on purpose strategies in Scandinavia and the Nordics and in Germany, because the German and the Nordic consumers demanded more of their. Can you hear the music in the background?
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? It's lovely.
Singing.
It's
yeah,
fantastic.
It's great. So they're having a major discussion here. I don't know. They're debating the merits of marketing or something.
Yeah, well, there we are, exactly.
So I think there's a tremendous amount of energy right now coming, you know, as this crisis continues on, rolls on. As I said earlier, the companies are realizing that brands that have a purpose are going to thrive. So the elevation of purpose is really a return to fundamentals, to one's roots. This is important, but it's not everything. And I think, you know, companies that that look at purpose also need to look at the way forward in these crazy times. And the CEO of Microsoft said recently, Satya Nadella, he wrote it was a really interesting letter to all his employees, and he said, it is in times of great disruption and uncertainty that our ability to stay grounded in our sense of purpose and remain true to our identity is of the utmost importance. And, you know, I think he writes about, obviously, their heritage, but it's really about how the company is adapting to this new world we're living in. And I think that's really, really critical. And there is, I think, a greater demand from leaders of organizations today to have partners who can help them figure out their purpose for both corporate brands and also product brands. You know, it's a big question for brand managers. How do I create a purpose strategy and activate that for a brand, a product brand, effectively, and sell product? Like, that's a huge conundrum for them. Like, a lot of brand managers may think, well, purpose is like brand, and I just need to sell stuff. How do I actually marry the two? And and we figured out a way to do that. So I think, you know, we've been getting quite a number of calls from clients that want to activate their purpose. There's a lot of companies that have spent a lot of money developing purpose strategies, but haven't figured out how to activate them.
Yeah. And by the way, in terms of that, without giving any sort of agency secrets, I mean, from the point of view, you mentioned collaboration earlier on. So, I mean, do you tend to, do you get involved in a lot of collaboration in terms of working with other people? I mean, the reason I ask is the other day I was doing some stuff and gave a talk with the Network One. I know you're, you know, totally obviously aware of, in terms of being a big sort of agency group. And so, you know, the big point that Julian, the MD, was mentioning there for all the people who were in on that sort of global webinar was that, you know, this is, you know, we've seen lots and lots of client side brands and businesses during the pandemic linking up together, often with competitors, in order to do things in this instance for the public good. At the same time, there appears to be a lot of retrenching going on. The Economist talks about one of the impacts of this will be the big companies in many sectors just get bigger. The medium-sized ones have a huge, huge problem, as always, and the small ones are really under the cosh. So Network One saying, you know, got to be stronger together, linking up with other agencies or other suppliers. And you know, one of the things they said was, and I quote it, they said that global agency networks are neither well-designed for original thinking, nor are they particularly well-designed for local customization. So I wonder, in terms of when you're doing your sort of international activity or whatever, does Strawberry Frog have a set number of collaborative partners, or do you tend to go it alone and sort of just tweak it in each country? Is there a general sort of a way of doing it?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. So Julian, when I was doing my research to start Strawberry Frog back in the late 90s, I met Julian at the time. I think he was the managing director of AIR agency in London, and I heard through the grapevine that he was an extraordinary mind, and we met, and I talked to him about this idea I had for Strawberry Frog, which was a confederation of independent individuals, companies, competitors, in order to provide a faster, better, cheaper product for clients. And I think he really bought into it. At the time, I don't think he was prepared to move from London to Amsterdam, which is where we started. But as you remember, I mean, we worked together back in the 90s and in the 2000s. Yeah. Because that was our whole business model, you know, that you should work together, create sort of an A team or the Avengers of talented individuals and companies. And we did, you know, we had a design firm in New Zealand. We had a design firm in Australia. We had one in San Francisco. We had several in London. We worked with Why Not Associates in London. We had them in Amsterdam. In fact, we did, one of our first clients was, we did the whole building design and launch of L.com. And there was five of us in Amsterdam. And the rest were spread out across the world. And that model of working with external people, I think we were the first company in the world to use freelancers as a force for good and not, you know, hide them. I think at the time when we started, a lot of companies used freelancers, but they never admitted it. It was like they were fearful. And we turned it up inside out and said, no, we actually, that's a benefit. You know, we have thousands of talented people we can work with 24/7. And that lets us work faster and better. So I would say, you know, we continue to work with a lot of extraordinary people, you know, inside Strawberry Frog and externally around the world, both independent talent teams, companies, competitors. And so, yes, all of the above, very much important in a world that's changing. I mean, basically what you're saying is, you know, you're reframing your capabilities. And that's really the most dramatic and direct approach. You know, if your business makes something, could it make something better in a crisis situation? You know, is your business providing services that could be reframed with competitors? That's a really important thought process to go through as a leader of a company. And that will lead to, you know, a more successful benefit for you and for your clients if you're in the marketing business.
Very good, very inspiring. Well, look, Scott, it's been so interesting. I mean, just literally last couple of questions in terms of the time that we have, and it's been, I say, really, really fascinating. I mean, just in terms of how, I mean, again, the sort of the crystal ball question. So, you know, here we are talking again this time next year. So when you're in sort of mid 2021, looking back over what happened next, how do you see the next few months, indeed year, playing out? And it's the ultimate question, but are you fearful? Are you confident? Anything in between or something else entirely? How are you looking at things going forward?
I think you really need to shift your head, your team, your organization from panic to purpose. And I think the coronavirus pandemic has obviously brought the economy to its knees. You know, stock market's tanking, revenues are falling. There's a, you know, just sheer terror at the prospect of what's around the corner. And I think it's easy to feel, you know, panicked by all of this. And a lot of organizations probably are still in sort of still frozen. In inaction and pursuing frantic measures of self-preservation. I mean, if you think about it, when you go through these types of shocks, people respond in panic. I think we've probably been in panic mode for the last 2 months. Mm. And I think these times just allow you to just pause for a moment. And as leaders, you really should be thinking about reassurance and inspiration and courage through this storm. I mean, I love sailing. And I can tell you right now, the most boring time is when the sea is still and waters are calm. I love it when the ocean is churning and when the waves are high and the wind is blowing. Like for me, that is when I'm at my best. And I feel like we're in the middle of a storm right now and on the sea. And it's, you know, grabbing hold of the rope, pulling it in, you know, keeping your feet firmly on the deck. That's what it's all about right now. And I'm confident that, you know, while we're, you know, this is not the best of times, it's really a moment to just ask the question, you know, what is it best for? And, you know, it's business as usual is impossible, but what is business? What is possible? You know, what does better look like? And I think that's where, you know, working with a purpose, that's where it can get you. You know, it can steer your mind, it can steer your colleagues, it can steer your organization from this panic to a purpose, and it can help you to activate that purpose so that you provide the kind of stability for your clients, your customers, all the buyers of your brand, and start to build momentum back into your organization. And to me, that is a strategy for getting to a stable, thriving space in the next 2 years. So it's going from panic to recovery to thriving. And in order to go from panic to recovery to thriving, you really need to shift from purpose. From panic to purpose.
Yeah. That was so interesting, Scott. Thank you very, very much indeed. And just so everyone is clear again, but just to remind us of the how people can either follow stroke contact you on social media, and then also the contact details for the agency, and also about that masterclass you mentioned.
Yeah. So if you want, I mean, don't listen to anything I've said, you know, although they always say every disaster movie starts with the government ignoring a scientist. So, you know, now, everyone's ignoring the scientists. I'm by no means a scientist, but I think I have some inputs that are interesting. If you want to follow those inputs, you can certainly pick up my book, Uprising. I'm actually, thanks to you, Sean, I'm writing a new book, which hopefully will come out in the new year.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you've certainly inspired me, and this crisis has given me the time to do that. And it'll be about movement think and how that changes leadership and how it changes, how it reframes internal culture and also marketing. But if you want more information about Strawberry Frog, you can go to strawberryfrog.com. And if you want to get information on the masterclass, you can actually email Leslie@strawberryfrog.com or Nicole@strawberryfrog.com. And if you want to see the birds that are chirping in the background, I'll set up some kind of cam so you can take a look at them as well.
Superb. It's been absolutely brilliant. Thanks, Scott, so much. And the birds are absolutely superb and an excellent thing to it. But I mean, we've covered a lot of ground there, but certainly the issues around from panic to purpose, and your points about, you know, just thinking about, you know, what is possible, what does better look like, and feet firmly on the deck in these turbulent times, looking to happier days ahead, hopefully, is a suitably inspiring and progressive way of looking at it. So, Scott Goodson, thanks very much.
Well, you're very inspiring, and I reread your book again just to inspire me, because your thinking has just a tremendous amount of provocation in it. So it's important in these times, you know, to be able to formulate good ideas. You really need provocative thoughts, and
picking up your book and reading them, reading it, I should say, but has been really helpful for me.
Well, very kind of you. Scott, very nice indeed. I'll send you the appropriate payment for saying that in due course. So very good.
All righty.
All right. Thanks, Scott. All the best. Cheers. All
right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the New Abnormal podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Please leave a rating, tell your friends, and until next time, goodbye.